So welcome everyone to the Strong Gravity Seminar of this week. So today we have us being a mini from Caltech. Paz is right now is a Moore fellow at Caltech, and I think in the fall he's moving to Israel to start his faculty position at Open University of Israel. So today he will be talking about the structure of gamma ray burst. Paz, please take it away.
Thanks a lot, Juan, for the introduction, and thanks for inviting me to give this talk. So it would have been very nice to also visit in person one day, but it's nice to visit virtually as well. And indeed, I want to tell you today a story about the structure of gamma ray bursts, kind of tell you the perspective that we have so far in the field, at least from my point of view and people I collaborate with on this topic. Some of this is going to be related to the gamma ray burst 17817, which is the one that followed the neutron star merger, very famous one. But you will see that there's also quite a lot of other information that we can get from GRBs that are not seen in gravitational waves. Okay, so let's start with a very brief introduction to gamma ray bursts. I suspect most of you may know this, but just so that we're all on the same page. So gamma ray bursts are some of the most extreme explosions in nature. They involve releases of huge amounts of energy in very brief periods of time, between a fraction of a second to tens of seconds. The way in which gamma ray bursts form, we think there are two main channels that this can happen. Either the collapse of a very massive star to a black hole or neutron star at the center, which then launches a jet. These are known as long GRBs. They typically have durations of, say, tens of seconds. Or you can have a merger of a compact binary system, neutron star, or neutron star black hole. Again, this forms some kind of central engine, black hole or neutron star, which launches a jet, and the story continues in the same way from there. So once this jet is launched, it is moving at a very highly relativistic speed with a Lorentz factor of, say, a few hundreds. Due to some internal process in the jet, energy is converted into internal energy that can then be radiated. And as it happens, most of this energy turns to radiation in gamma rays, in soft gamma rays, at a frequency peaking somewhere around 100 kV or so, and being extremely variable in time, and as I told you, quite brief, lasting only a fraction of a second or tens of seconds. This is the main phase of the gamma ray burst, which we call the prompt emission. After this prompt emission, there is another phase of emission, which is known as the afterglow. This, in terms of the physics, happens when the remaining energy in the jet starts being decelerated by the external medium surrounding the central engine. And once this jet is decelerated, you get a shock running into the external medium, another reverse shock running into the material in the jet. This creates, again, emission, which is seen as the afterglow. It's gradually decreasing in time. It's much smoother in its dependence on time. And it covers a very wide range of frequencies, all the way from radio to very high energy gamma rays. And when we specifically look at the radio, these things can remain visible for months and even years after the original event. Okay, so this is a very broad brush picture of gamma ray bursts, but I want to emphasize that there are still many very basic questions about this field which remain unanswered. And a lot of them have to do with this initial stage of the gamma ray burst, the prompt emission. And essentially this happens on every step of the way towards the creation of the gamma rays. So right at the beginning, I told you that there's a central engine. It could either be a black hole or it could be a rapidly rotating and very magnetized neutron star known as a magnetar. And still, there is no consensus on which one of those options explains gamma ray bursts. Maybe we need both of them. Then on the next stage, we have the jet itself. So again, there is no consensus whether the jet is dominated by the energy in the jet is dominated by matter particles, or it's mainly carried by electromagnetic fields, pointing flux dominated. Then we have the process of dissipation of this energy. If it's matter dominated, perhaps the way to release this energy is to have different parts of the jet move at slightly different velocities so that they collide. You have these shocks which could then release energy into thermal electrons that can then radiate. Or alternatively, if it's a pointing flux dominated jet, you could have a magnetic reconnection, which again accelerates the particles that then radiate. Or you could have other things that have been suggested, such as nuclear collisions and so on. Then you get the phase of the emission itself. And here as well, there is uncertainty. Maybe the two main channels that were proposed is synchrotron emission from a non-thermal relativistic electron distribution in a very strong magnetic field. We expect a significant synchrotron power. Or an additional option is that you get a lot of the dissipation happening below the photosphere of the jet, meaning at a region where the optical depth is still very high. And then some of this energy gets thermalized before it's released to the observer so that we get this photospheric-like component for the emission. All of these things are still strongly debated. However, for the second phase of the GRB, for the afterglow, the situation is quite a lot better. And the broad brush picture of the afterglow is pretty well understood in terms of the dynamics of the blast wave, which are simply described by this very nice self-similar blast wave solution for an ultra-relativistic blast wave developed by Blanford and McKee in 76. And then you get these two shocks, forward shock propagating into the external medium, reverse shock propagating into the ejecta, and mainly the contribution from this forward shock, which accelerates electrons in the downstream of the shock, and then they radiate through synchrotron. This is mainly what we see as the afterglow phase. And if you take this theory, which is very predictive and can be used to make very specific estimates for what we should expect to see as a function of time and frequency, it matches pretty well with the observations. There are some irregularities that I will talk about a bit later, but for the most part, it matches well. Now, since it is a good match to observations, I want to briefly explain the very simplest understanding of what is going on during this phase so that we can then see how things change once we are no longer in the simplest scenario. So imagine that there is a jet, and for simplicity, we will assume that the jet is this cone of opening angle theta naught, and anywhere within that cone, you get equal amounts of emissivity, and outside of that cone, you get nothing. Okay, so now if this whole jet is moving relativistically at some Lorentz factor gamma, you recall that due to relativistic beaming, emission from these particles is mostly coming within a narrow cone of 1/γ above the direction of motion. This means that relative to the line of sight, we are mainly seeing particles that are within a cone of 1/γ, within this blue cone that you see here, relative to us. So if 1/γ is small compared to theta naught, in the beginning, we don't notice the fact that the jet has an edge. We only see this small fraction of the jet from which we couldn't know that the jet has an edge. And as time goes by, as long as we are still within that phase, nothing changes in terms of the amount of isotropic equivalent energy that we see. The amount of isotropic equivalent energy that we see remains constant, meaning that to first approximation, the luminosity should decrease roughly as 1/T. All of this continues up until a critical point where 1/γ becomes larger than theta naught. At that point, suddenly the observer realizes that there are some regions that should be observable, but there is no emission coming from those regions. So what you get is that if you extrapolate the luminosity from the previous time step, you will overpredict the luminosity at this step. So you'll get a steepening of the luminosity at this point. And since this is a geometric effect, and you can also easily understand from this explanation that it's going to be mostly achromatic, this is known as a jet break. The name that people give this is a jet break, okay? And again, this is a very robust feature that we expect to see in GRB afterglows if we have this jet-like structure to the emission. Okay, so now let's go forward in time, and let's go to 3.5 years ago when the first neutron star merger was detected in gravitational waves by LIGO. This was very exciting. Not only will we see these gravitational waves coming from the merger, but within about a second later, we also saw gamma rays. And later on, we also saw other electromagnetic counterparts, the kilonova, the afterglow itself, even some days after and so on. And this was extremely useful for the GRB community, because not only is this the closest GRB ever observed, it's also literally observed from a different point of view. So it's triggered by this gravitational wave, but also really literally we are looking not right at the jet like we usually do in gamma ray bursts, but from a large offset relative to the jet. And even in terms of the properties of the gamma ray burst, they are very different than standard gamma ray bursts that we see from cosmological distances. The luminosity of the gamma ray burst that was seen with the 170817 was about 4 or 5 orders of magnitude smaller than typical cosmological short GRBs. So there are many things that we have learned from this event, and I won't have time to go over all of them, but I want to stress the bottom line result that we have from this many observations and many detailed works that have been done. And this is that after the merger, we had a jet. It was relatively narrow. It was successful in breaking out of the ejecta around the neutron star merger, meaning it didn't stall, it managed to break through. And it was pointing away from the line of sight. And just to kind of quickly illustrate how we know some of those things, one very nice way to see this is from this observation of superluminal motion. You look at the radio flux centroid and you see how it moves on the sky. It moves superluminally on the sky, which tells you that there is something moving at a velocity very close to the speed of light and at an angle that is not right at us. And you can actually do this quantitatively and estimate the Lorentz factor. You can also see this from the shape of the afterglow light curve. So the afterglow was very well studied. You can see here the light curve in radio and in X-rays, both showing similar temporal evolutions. And you can see that this afterglow peaked at around 150 days. By the way, you can immediately see that it looks very different from what I just showed you in the previous slide, and we'll get to that in a second. And you see that after this peak, it's declining quite rapidly. The fact that it's declining quite rapidly is also telling us that there was a jet here and that we were looking at it off axis. And I will explain this point in a bit more detail in the next few minutes. So in order to see this last point, let's now have this cartoon in mind, which will maybe help us to consider what's going on. So imagine that you have a jet. And now let's take a slightly more complicated version of the jet we had before, which has some angular structure around it, meaning that as a function of latitude, there is decreasing energy beyond some angle which denotes the jet core. So you have a constant energy within the core and then some decreasing energy beyond that. Okay, and now we're observing this jet from a large offset relative to the axis. So this is this theta observed that you see here. And at early times, only a small fraction of this jet is able to efficiently radiate towards us within this 1/γ cone that we talked about before. So we're only seeing a very small fraction of the true energy of the jet. This corresponds to this early times in the light curve. That's why we see a small amount of flux, because there's so little energy involved. As time goes by, this 1/γ angle increases because this whole jet is decelerating. So as 1/γ increases, we can see closer and closer to the core of the jet where there is more energy, so much more energy that it more than compensates for the fact that all of this material has had time to decelerate before we see it. And in this case, instead of getting a declining luminosity going roughly as 1/T, we actually get an increasing luminosity in this phase, which lasts for a very long time, as I said, about 150 days, until eventually we see basically the full energy of the jet. Once we've reached roughly the core of the jet, we've seen the full energy. There's no more gains to be made by increasing 1/γ. And from this point on, the situation is exactly the same as a jet viewed on axis that is after the jet break. We've seen all the energy, the 1/γ is no longer important, and therefore we'll expect a decline in exactly the same way. It goes roughly as t^-p, where p is the slope of the electron energy distribution, and this matches very well with the observations. So the fact that we see this shape of the light curve, especially after the peak, before the peak there was still not quite a consensus as to whether or not you need a jet to explain this, but once you see this very sharp decline after the peak, there was a consensus that the jet is needed. So again, like in cosmological GLBs, we see that the afterglow is relatively well understood, and maybe unsurprisingly, the prompt emission, where there is much more sparse data, is much less understood. And the main question that remains open is, what is the source of the gamma rays that were viewed in this GLB? So it's clear that we are observing far from the axis, but roughly speaking, there are two groups of explanations that you can think of. One saying that there is a lot of energy, even at the side lobes of this jet, but the fact that all of this material is now moving much slower, it's not moving at very high Lorentz factors, means that whatever is the production of, whatever is the mechanism of production of gamma rays that we typically see in GLBs on axis is no longer efficient in this case. And now we get some other mechanism. One specific mechanism that people discuss is shock breakout from a cocoon, which produces a very tiny amount of gamma rays compared to the actual energy content that you have along the line of sight. The other type of explanation is saying, no, simply what is happening is that there is much less energy along the line of sight because, as we said, there is this declining angular profile of the jet. And even if you imagine that the same exact process is going on with the same efficiency, you will still get much less gamma rays. So you can see how different structures are needed for these two explanations. And one way to differentiate between them is if we had a good way of saying what is the underlying structure of a GLB jet. This is, of course, something that people have studied quite a lot. And the main way that people study this is using numerical simulations, hydro and magnetohydrodynamic simulations of GLB jets. But these are very difficult simulations to do. They involve many scales in time and in space, and generally, to do this in full 3D and in high resolution is not something that can be done at this point with a high enough resolution. So there are many groups working on this, and they, as you can see here, have quite a different results for what is the expectation for the energy and for the Lorentz factor as a function of angle. So, of course, this is an interesting exploration and one that should be continued, but it also suggests that in the meantime, we maybe have to think of something else that can constrain the structures of GLB jets. And that's what I want to propose to you. And specifically, what I want to propose is that we already have quite a lot of information about GLB jets from the GLBs that we have seen in the last 10, 15 years, from cosmological distances. And I will focus in the next part of the talk mainly on long GLBs, simply because we have a bit more information about those, but I will get back to short GLBs later. So I will show you a few different ways in which we can constrain the structure, and then we can sort of draw the conclusions from those different constraints. So the first one has to do with a correlation that people have noticed between the luminosity that is released in X-rays at early times after the burst, say 100 seconds after the burst or 1 hour after the burst, and the energy released in gamma rays during the prompt emission. So you see this correlation here on the left-hand side. It does have a scatter, but the scatter is not huge. It's maybe half an order of magnitude. And by the way, the sample to the left has been chosen very carefully so that it's complete in redshift and there are no observational biases, but it's also compelling to notice that even if you take all of the Swift GLBs and Swift Cs, both in X-rays and in soft gamma rays, and simply plot a histogram of the X-ray flux at some given time relative to the gamma ray fluence, you still get the same median and the same scatter roughly as you find in this redshift complete sample. So it seems pretty robust that this correlation is there. And why is this important? So the reason that this is important is that, as I will show you in a second, once you imagine that there's a structure beyond the core of the jet for the energy and for the Lorentz factor, you quickly tend to overestimate this scatter in energy released in X-rays during the early afterglow to energy released in gamma rays during the prompt emission. And the reason is the following. So if we think about the prompt emission, the amount of energy that you see when you're observing at a given latitude to first approximation is dominated simply by the energy content there times some efficiency. But for now, we will assume always that the efficiency does not change as a function of angle, and we will return to this assumption later. You can see this by looking at this left-hand side plot here. And what you see here in the dashed lines are different energy structures. So you see the energy emitted as a function of angle. And in solid lines of the same color, you see the energy observed as a function of angle. And the two are not exactly the same, because if you are sitting on one angle, you get contribution from material right along your line of sight, but you can also get contribution from material at lines of sight which are slightly closer to the core and more energetic. So once you go to very large viewing angles, indeed that becomes the dominant effect, but mostly for viewing angles that are reasonably close to the core and for jet structures that are not extremely steep, you're dominated simply by the energy along the line of sight. So as a first approximation, we can consider that. What happens for the early afterglow phase? So in this situation, if you observe early enough, you're looking at material that has not yet had time to decelerate. It turns out that in this regime, the amount of luminosity that you get is very strongly dependent on the Lorentz factor of the material that is moving towards you. And it depends on this Lorentz factor to the 8th power. So you can see that very quickly, the ratio between those two things will start changing very rapidly. And you see it here for different models. And you see that as long as you're within the core of the jet, of course, this is constant by construction. Once you go out of the core, this star changes by many orders of magnitude, much, much more than what we saw in the previous slide with the scatter between LX over E gamma. So clearly, models that have this behavior where you see this very large scatter at large viewing angles, and those are viewing angles that we restrict ourselves only to such viewing angles that the energy will still be observable in the gamma rays in the first place, those models are clearly ruled out by the data. One can do all of this much more quantitatively and taking care of all the details that you don't see in this back of the envelope calculation. And the result is what you see here. So on the x-axis, this is the slope of the energy profile beyond the core. We take it to be some theta to the minus alpha. On the y-axis, it's the slope of the Lorentz factor distribution above the core. We take it to be theta to the minus beta. And you see that generally you need a steep structure in energy and a shallow structure in Lorentz factor in order to be consistent with this type of constraint. Okay, so the allowed region here is the one in dark colors. Another completely independent constraint comes from the luminosity function of gamma ray bursts. So what this is you see the fluxes of GRBs, and for many of them we have redshifts, and you can estimate the distribution of gamma ray luminosities at the central engine frame, okay? And that has some kind of peaked distribution that is inferred from observations. These are these blue bars that you see here. And for a given model, you can ask whether or not it will be consistent with these observations in the following sense. So for each jet that you have with some amount of energy along the core, there are many copies of that jet that will be viewed at greater angles than the core and will be seen to have a much lower luminosity, because we're saying now that there is some profile for the energy as a function of angle. Since there is much more solid angle that is associated with these greater angles, then these bursts that would be much less luminous should be quite common. And you can also check whether or not they are still in the range that they are not so dim that they are no longer observable. But as long as they are still observable, this creates a soft tail to the luminosity function. And you see here an example in orange for this kind of soft tail that will be produced for one such model of a jet structure. And you see clearly that it over predicts the number of soft bursts relative to observations, even if you assume that intrinsically there are no jets that have luminosity less than this peak at their core, less than this L star at their core. So quite conservatively, you can say that this group of models is ruled out. So what you are left with is a relatively narrow region in parameter space that is shown here, again, in terms of this alpha and beta. But actually, even this region is not really allowed. So imagine that we take a point here that is very shallow in beta. In fact, we can take beta of zero, and that is relatively steep in alpha. We can take alpha of five as an example. And even for this case, you can look at the actual afterglow light curves that you will obtain within observation angles that are such that the gamma rays are still detectable in the first place. And what you get is you get these light curves that you can see here in X-rays and in optical. And you see that both those light curves are very shallow for a very extended amount of time. For about tens of days, they continue being very shallow and maybe so show these bumps in the light curve. This is inconsistent not even with a fraction of the GRBs, but actually with all GRBs. There's not even a single one that decays as shallowly as this over this timescale period of tens of days. All of them decay at least as t to the minus half. And again, these should be very common events if this was the true underlying structure because of the amount of solid angle associated with such viewing angles. So it seemed like we are now in a problematic situation. We've basically ruled out all of our parameter space. So what can we do? Well, if you remember, we had an assumption early on, and the assumption was that the efficiency is constant as a function of angle. So meaning that the amount of energy that you convert to gamma rays does not depend on the angle. If now we revisit this assumption and we say that this is no longer the case, then we can regain consistency with all three of those observations. And we can state it in a slightly different way. Instead of saying that the efficiency is specifically a function of angle, really what is needed for consistency here is to say that only material that is very highly relativistic can participate in producing gamma rays. Only material that has a Lorentz factor of at least 50 or so can efficiently produce gamma rays. As long as that is the case, then the situation is consistent with these observational constraints. In terms of observation angle, it means that we can view jets slightly off axis, but maybe 50% above the angle of the core, not much more than that. This may indicate that what we saw in 17 or 817 was an example of a completely different process of gamma ray production, such as shock breakout from a cocoon. But of course, this is not yet conclusive. One way in which this can be explored in more detail is once we see in the near future.
So may I ask a question about
this? Yeah, of course.
So you are saying the efficiency should depend on the Lorentz factor. Do you have a physical explanation for that? Or why?
Yes. So there are many models in which you expect this to naturally be the case, where the efficiency may even, the mechanism may even shut off completely once you go to low Lorentz factors. So just to give an illustrative example of this, one model that I mentioned in the introduction is this internal shocks model that imagines that you have different shells within the jet that have slightly different Lorentz factor, they collide, and this dissipates energy and releases it eventually into gamma rays. So the radius at which you get collision of internal shocks scales as gamma squared times the variability time, which is the time between the ejection of this of the shells. The radius of the photosphere scales as 1/γ^3. And the photosphere is a critical radius here because only if you have dissipation above the photosphere, the energy can be immediately released to gamma rays. If your energy is released well below the photosphere, well, you will suffer from many adiabatic losses by the time that this energy reaches a point where it can escape to the observer. So you will suffer a huge loss in efficiency. So you can see that the ratio of the internal shock radius to the photospheric radius goes as 5^γ^5. This is a very strong dependence. And it's very natural in such a situation that by changing gamma from 100 to say 10, you go from all of the shocks happening above the photosphere efficiency that is of order say 10% or something like that, like we observe in gamma ray bursts, to a situation where the efficiency basically cuts off and you get almost nothing out.
Okay, cool, thanks.
So,
sorry, Paz, can I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah, sure.
So I was wondering, so you're mentioning the internal shock model, but so I thought that this was sort of somewhat in tension with the band function that that is observed in GRB spectra. So I was wondering, in terms of the photospheric model, do you have any explanation of how this efficiency and why this efficiency changes as a function of Lorentz vector?
Yeah, so actually, let me start with a question about the band function. So I think band function definitely is not a good description of the GRB spectrum. A more recent analysis of the spectrum shows that you can actually fit it quite well with a synchrotron marginally slow cooling spectrum, where you see two breaks quite close to each other, the cooling break and the injection break, the synchrotron injection break, relatively close. And by trying to fit with just a band function, so just to tell everyone else that may not be familiar with the band function, it's basically a broken power law, smoothly broken power law function. By trying to fit to that function, there are some artifacts involved in that. And the fits tend turn out to be bad, and also the slopes that you get can actually be very misleading compared to the actual slopes that you will get by fitting to a model that is physical and comes from, say, synchrotron or some other process. And this led people to claim that there are many cases that are completely inconsistent with synchrotron. But this should be taken with a grain of salt, because again, the underlying model that they use to make this constraint is not the physical one. And because they used typically time unresolved data to do this analysis. So if the GRB comes in many pulses and you take a bunch of pulses and you try to get the spectrum of all of them together, if you imagine that the properties change from one pulse to another, then things smooth out. And of course, you lose the intrinsic spectrum that you had originally. So these things have to be taken into account. It's still a very much debated topic as to what do we actually see in the spectrum. I think there are some GRBs where it's convincing that there is a photospheric component, but even in those, it seems that this component is not dominant in energy. It carries a small amount of the overall energy. And that is in principle okay with something like internal shocks, because if you have some of those shocks happening below the photosphere, you will expect some photospheric component. Of course, there are other options. For example, myself and others have worked on magnetic jets for GRBs, and there the situation is also quite different. You may also expect synchrotron to be the main emission mechanism, but there are other details which will change. So I think the question of the GRB spectrum is still quite open, but it has been advancing quite nicely in the last few years. So I don't know, does this answer your question?
Sure, thanks. That's great.
Okay, good. So I mentioned that we find this idea that the efficiency should change as a function of angle to be the one that could be consistent with the data of long GRBs. One way to actually test what is the emission mechanism at large viewing angles will be to have a few more events where they are detected jointly between gravitational waves and gamma rays. And one thing that we have shown in this work that you see here is that the rate of events that we expect from these different mechanisms that were proposed is very different. The rate of those joint detections is going to be very different. And furthermore, the distributions that you will get for the luminosities and for the viewing angles will be very different as well. So quite quickly, one would be able to differentiate between these different models by just having a few events with joint gamma rays and gravitational wave detections. So this is for the future, but perhaps there is already something that we can say right now about the structure of the jets. And what I want to show you next is that we think that there is such a thing. And you remember that one of the ways in which we argued about viewing jets from very large viewing angles is that this will lead to very extended episodes of flat light curves in the afterglow, which are not observed. However, there are episodes of flat light curves that are observed, and they are simply observed for a slightly shorter timescale between about 100 seconds to about 10 to the 5 seconds. These are called X-ray plateaus. They are seen in the X-ray afterglows, and they are very common. About 40% of GRBs have X-ray plateaus. And as you saw from the light curves that I showed you before, this is very naturally expected if you view the jet slightly off axis, but this time we're not going to view it from an angle of 0.3 radians. We're only going to view it from an angle of maybe 0.12 radians or 0.13 radians. And as you can see here, you see in the different plots how the luminosity will change as a function of this angular offset. You see that it becomes flatter and flatter, the peak becomes later and later. And actually with a very small change of this delta theta, you can get a very wide range of the duration of this plateau, which is consistent with what is observed. Also, you can see that the shape of these plateaus can be either sort of bumpy in the case that the external medium is has a uniform density, or it can be kind of flat if the external medium is decreasing as a wind, as r to the minus 2. And I want to show you that actually when you look at real data, this bumpy feature is observed quite often. So if you look at some light curves here, you see that we call these X-ray plateaus, but actually very often we see these bumps, these smooth bumps in the light curve. So this is not so natural in some other mechanisms that were proposed for the plateau, but here it comes for free. The other nice thing that we find in this model is that it naturally reproduces the correlations that are observed between different properties of the plateau and the energy released in gamma rays. So for example, you see two of those correlations here. The black dots are from the data, and the colored regions are from our models, and you see that they can naturally explain these correlations. And I want to emphasize that these correlations, for example, the one on the left, are very simple to understand intuitively in this model. So in this model, we're observing off axis. So initially, we are seeing only a small fraction of the energy that is beamed towards us. But once we get to the peak of the, or to the end of the plateau, this is once we, this is at the time that 1/γ from the line of sight reaches the core of the jet. So at that point, we see the full energy of the jet. That's why the luminosity of the plateau times the duration of the plateau is expected to roughly correlate with the entire energy of the GRB and therefore with the energy of the gamma rays in our model. This is not what you would expect in a situation which people have suggested in the past, where the plateaus are an indication of energy injection from some central engine. Because in that case, the amount of energy that is available at the time of the gamma rays is a tiny fraction of the energy that will be available later during the afterglow. And there's no reason that those two should know about each other. This explanation also reproduces the fraction of bursts that have plateaus quite easily, if we just take into account those typical viewing angles from which we think that gamma rays can be efficiently produced, as I told you before. And it naturally explains the fact that we don't see a spectral break between the time of the plateau itself and the time just after the plateau. One final thing that is related to this that I want to mention is that the same interpretation for the plateaus may also explain X-ray flares. So another very common feature in X-ray afterglows, maybe the second mysterious feature of X-ray afterglows, is the X-ray flares. These are again common. They are seen in maybe 30% of GRBs, and they are these very brief and intense periods of emission in X-rays, as you can see here on the right-hand side in the data. And in our picture, these can be coming from de-boosted emission from the gamma rays that were emitted along the core, but are now off-axis to us, the observers. And since they're off-axis to us, then they are Doppler de-boosted. So instead of being in gamma rays, we will see them in X-rays. Instead of seeing them a second after the burst has started, we will see them tens or hundreds of seconds after, and we will see them with lower energy. So all of these things will give you an X-ray flare. You can see some examples from our models on the left, and you see that it can look rather similar to the data. In fact, this decline that you see at the end of the flare is the same slope that we would expect in our interpretation, where the slope is simply dominated by a high latitude emission from parts of the emitting patch that are at angular offsets greater and greater from the line of sight. So we think this is quite an elegant explanation, potentially. We're still working on all the details. This is a paper in preparation. And it certainly would be nice if we can provide one explanation that at the same time understands both the X-ray flares and the X-ray plateaus, which I think are the two main kind of outstanding phenomena in GLB afterwards. So,
can I ask another question? Just following up on this. So this is all very interesting. So if I recall correctly, so some of these X-ray flares have like durations that are comparable to the time after the burst where they occur. So they are sort of have some memory of the time scale in which they occur. So wouldn't this be in contradiction or is somewhat in tension with that being a deboosted sort of prompt emission?
Good question. So the energy, the duration of the flares that is observed is roughly scales with the time at which they appear. So in other words, delta T of the flare is proportional to the time of the flare. And the proportionality, in some cases, it's narrow, like you see here. And on average, it's about 0.2. So delta T is of order 0.2 of the time of the flare. But there is a wide scatter. This is actually, the fact that there is a proportionality is exactly what we expect in the model. And the reason is exactly this angular time scale that is involved. So the time that we start seeing the flare is the time that you start seeing photons from the closest line of sight of this emitting patch to you. And the time that you stop seeing the flare is the time at the from the furthest away photons that you have along this patch. And so then, depending on the size of this angular patch relative to the angular offset, you could get delta T divided by T of order unity very easily if you just say take the patch to be the full size of the core of the jet. In fact, that is what you expect. It's quite difficult to get below that. And one of the main things that we are trying to understand in our model and which delayed us with the, immediately coming up with this and saying everything is solved is that actually there are quite a few cases where delta T over T is narrow. And that is much more difficult to do with patches. You need the patches themselves to be very narrow as well. So one can show that the angular size of the patches should be relatively small, maybe even a few times 1/gamma. So that is potentially, in my mind, the most difficult thing for this model to do. But we think it's not impossible, and we have some potential ways around it. But anyway, I agree that the narrow delta T over T is the part that we have to pay attention to. The fact that delta T is proportional to T is actually comes for free. That part is natural.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Good. So let me move to the final part. I don't know how am I doing with the time. Am I still okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So in the final part of the talk, I want to talk about some, again, future prospects, but now looking at afterglows that will be jointly detection with jointly detected with gravitational waves. And what I want to show is that for the afterglows, again, they can be very useful for telling us something about the structure of the jets once we view them off axis. And the reason that afterglows are useful here is that, first of all, afterglows are much more likely to be jointly detected with gravitational waves as compared to the prompt GLB. Simply because they are brighter for longer, and for example, in radio, it's much more easy to detect them compared to our capabilities in gamma rays. And so it's useful to try and understand them and to try and understand what afterglows from structured jets, now that we know that structured jets are the ingredient that is needed to explain GLBs, what do they look like when you view them off axis? This is something that people have studied quite a lot numerically. For example, what they do with 17 or 817 is they will have numerical fitting models where you can put the observed parameters into your model. You have many model parameters. You churn all of this data in, and eventually you come up with some plots for the likely values of the parameters. But it's important to stress that there are many degeneracies in these models, and it's difficult to remove all of these degeneracies with the observations that we have. Even with the great observations that we have for 17 or 817, they remain many degeneracies that are you cannot break with this data. So what I want to suggest here is that a complementary way of thinking of this problem is to look at it from an analytical perspective. And I will show you that if we choose the right variables, we can actually get a lot of information that is completely independent of those degenerate properties that are often involved in afterglow modeling. So to begin, let's look at this plot here, which shows the flux centroid for an observer that is at the center of this circle here from a jet that is centered on this white X to the left. Okay, so the jet is off center to the observer, and we're viewing it as a function of time. Time goes from left to right and then from top to bottom. So you see that in the earliest time, we are mainly seeing emission from around the line of sight. But as time goes by, we start seeing emission coming from closer and closer angles to the core of the jet, until eventually the emission from the core of the jet completely dominates what we see. So already from here, you can see that a very important characteristic that will tell us how the emission changes as a function of time is what is the lowest latitude that is observable at any given time. So we will call this latitude theta minimum. Roughly speaking, to first approximation, this is the angle from which 1/γ reaches the observer. So one can estimate what this angle is. You can do it at different levels of simplification, but you can actually analytically get this dot dashed curve that you see here in the plot. And you see that it matches exactly, as far as the eye can tell at least, with this solid curve, which is the full solution obtained by integrating numerically over the jet profile. So we can get analytically a good understanding for how this theta mean is evolving as a function of time. Okay, good. So now that we have this angle, we will need to define a couple more important angles in the problem, and then combining everything together, we will be able to get some light curve. So let's look at the profile of the Lorentz factor as a function of angle. And the solid line that you see here is the profile at some time zero before anything has had any time to decelerate. And then once this jet propagates, the material starts to decelerate. And typically, this depends on the structure of the jet, but for most structures that are in the reasonable area of parameter space, the jet will decelerate from inside out. So there is, at some time t1, there is an angle theta deceleration, which is the angle of material currently decelerating. Everything below that angle has already decelerated. Everything above is still coasting. There is another important angle, which is theta beam. This is the angle below which theta times gamma falls below unity. Why is this important? Because this means that material from that angle is no longer strongly beamed. You remember this 1/γ compared to theta that we talked about earlier in the talk. And what you see is that as long as we are observing at some angle below theta star, this theta beam will occur at a lower angle relative to theta deck. But once we go above theta star, which is the angle for which you get this gamma theta equals unity from the beginning, then from the very first moment of observation, the material is already such that it's all unbeamed along the line of sight, and we have to wait until some time later when it becomes decelerated. So putting all of this in a plot, it looks something like this. So you can look at the characteristic angle as a function of time, So the deceleration is simply this power law. The theta beam will increase initially faster until you reach this critical theta star, above which there is no meaning to theta beam because all of this material is already unbeamed from the very first moment. So we can see that there are two types of light curves then that can be obtained. If we observe below theta star, then we will see deceleration happening before this beaming becomes unimportant. This means that what we will see is material that is initially not decelerated. And so initially the flux in the afterglow will rise, then the material decelerated. So then it will start declining, much like in a cosmological GRB seen on axis, where we see this T to the minus one decline. Then we have this T beam. So now this material starts becoming unbeamed, which means that we can start seeing material to the side of the line of sight, which has more energy. So we see this shallow increase in the light curve, much like we saw in 17 or 817, until eventually we see the full size of the jet, and then we get another decline. So you see from the description here that this is going to give us a double peaked light curve in this situation. In the other extreme, if theta observed is greater than theta star, then from the very first moment, beaming is unimportant from the line of sight, meaning that from the very first moment, we can efficiently view angles that are much closer to the core. And so we are already in this shallow increase phase of the emission, where we will simply get this shallow increase, looking closer and closer to the core of the jet, until we reach the core of the jet, and then we get a decline. So we will get a one peak light curve. So you can walk through all of this in more quantitative detail, and you can estimate what are the characteristic timescales here and what are the slopes of the light curve in each segment. And you can then get this analytical prescription that gives you a light curve for each viewing angle and jet structure. And you see here the results of those light curves relative to a full numerical integration over the jet profile. And you see that there is a good agreement between the two. We see this case of double peaked compared to the case of single peaked. And of course, the advantage of having all of this analytically is that it's easy to use. It gives us intuitive tools by which we can understand qualitatively what is going on. And it highlights what are the degenerate parameters as compared to things that can be robustly constrained from analytics. If we, instead of focusing on just the data as it is, we focus on the shape of the light curve. For example, the ratio between the time of the two peaks or the ratio between the fluxes of the two peaks. Things like that are completely independent of the highly uncertain parameters that are involved in GRB afterglow modeling, such as the density of the external medium, the total energy of the blast wave, and the fraction of energy that goes to electrons or to magnetic fields. So if you instead focus on these four parameters that you see here, the viewing angle relative to the core, the slopes of the energy and Lorentz factor profile, and the compactness of the core, those can be robustly obtained simply from the shape of the light curve and independently from the others. And just as an example, I want to show you that when we apply this to 17 or 817 as a test case, this can immediately tell us some interesting things. So in that case, we only saw the shallow rise phase, meaning that either this was a single peaked light curve, or if it was a double peaked one, the first peak should have been very early. So we have some constraint on the time of the first peak relative to the time of the second one, if there was indeed a first peak. And what you get from these constraints is an allowed region in terms of the slope of the Lorentz factor distribution and the Lorentz factor on the core of the jet. So this is the scalared region on the figure to the left. And you see that it matches well with the actual constraints from fitting procedures of the full data set to the numerical models. So this is on the right. And the overall conclusion is that we have a slope that has to be at least as steep as theta to the minus three. And we can say that the Lorentz factor along the core has to be at least 150 or something like that. And in particular, we get a very robust constraint for the Lorentz factor along the line of sight, which incidentally is also consistent with independent ways that we can estimate this, coming, for example, from the superluminal motion that I mentioned earlier, or from the compactness argument applied to the gamma rays seen early on in this event. So I will finish here. I just want to quickly conclude this talk. So I argued here that in long GRBs, we find that the efficiency of producing gamma rays has to be restricted only to material that is moving very fast and is therefore quite close to the core of the jet. However, if we are not exactly aligned with the core, but just slightly off axis, we can get all sorts of interesting things in the light curve, such as plateaus and maybe also X-ray flares. They seem to nicely explain all the different properties observed in those afterglow features. Whether or not this extends also to short GRBs is not entirely certain, because we don't know if the structure of short GRBs and long GRBs are similar or quite different. It's possible they are quite different. For short GRBs, one way that we can get more information about the gamma ray production outside of the core will be to start detecting events jointly in gamma rays and in gravitational waves, both for the prompt emission, but also if we detect the afterglow jointly with gravitational waves, this can give us a lot of information about the structure. And we have these two types of afterglow light curves that we predict with the double peak or the simple peak. I think once we start observing those types of light curves, this will be very interesting. It will tell us a lot about the structures of those jets. So thank you for your time, and stop here.
Okay, thank you, Paz. Any more questions?
Yes, I actually have two. Should I start?
Sure.
So Paz, I was wondering, so this is very interesting, your explanation for these X-ray plateaus and so on. I mean, this has been a very puzzling thing for a while. So I was wondering, since you mentioned that one needs to be very close, so the observer angle needs to be fairly close to the core. So how much fine-tuning does this need, considering that we see this these X-ray plateaus in a fairly large class of GRB? So is this consistent just with random orientations on the sky or something like that? I mean, I'm pretty sure you've made some basic estimates on this.
Yeah, so actually you can see the most basic of estimates here, which is basically if you just take the maximum viewing angle from which we think gamma rays are detectable, given the constraints I mentioned before, and you compare that to the size of the core. So just take the solid angle associated with this angular difference, compare that to the solid angle of the entire thing or of just the core, and you will find that, yeah, a fraction of order 40 or 50% of bursts should have plateaus, which is what is observed.
Okay.
This also then predicts, and this is something that we have in mind to look in at more detail in the future, that there should be all sorts of correlations between, for example, properties of the plateaus and properties of the gamma rays or properties of the flares, right? So if we think that this is a viewing angle explanation, so those cases where you're viewing further from the core should on average be less energetic, should on average also have later flares, the time of the flare should correlate with the duration of the plateau, things like that. That being said, one has to be a bit careful when directly comparing with the data, because generally with GRBs, we only observe the tip of the iceberg. We only observe those events that are energetic enough to be detected. So the fact that there could be other copies of such an event that are less energetic is one thing, but whether or not they're detectable is another. So we have to make sure that we're doing it with a sample that is complete such that we can really make comparison of apples to apples. But that's something that we definitely want to do.
Yeah, very nice. And so the other question I had, the other quick question is, regarding the synchrotron parameters, do you have an intuitive explanation of why they sort of factor out in your afterglow model. So
is very intuitive. So this modeling is really just about the shape. You can see that nothing here cares at all about the efficiency at which you produce the energy. So all it matters is that you're observing in a given band of the synchrotron flux. As long as you're not changing a band at some point during the observation, this will introduce some dependence on all of those parameters like density and epsilon B and so on. The ratio between fluxes at different times or different frequencies is completely scales out when you look at these relative durations or relative fluxes. So this is the advantage of looking at it in this way. And those assumptions are, I think, reasonable to be justified observationally in many cases. For example, in 17817, the radio and the X-rays are consistent with being on the same power law segment, both below the cooling break and above the injection break. And that continues to be the case all the time, all the way from the very first moment of observation at around 10 days after the event until now. It's still detectable now, and they're still continuing to behave very nicely together with each other.
Great, thank you.
All right, any other questions? If not, maybe I can ask one more question. I'm a bit lost at the end. So you were explaining this double peak light curve. This presumably, I guess, for short GRBs.
It could also be for long GRBs, as long as we can detect them off axis. So the challenge is that typically to detect a GRB, we detected by having a trigger from the gamma rays. And because of the points that I mentioned earlier, probably we don't detect gamma rays from GRBs that are very far off axis. The way around it is, for example, with gravitational waves, where you can detect GRBs from basically any angle. Or another way around it is using transient surveys that are rapid enough to cover the sky quite quickly and will be able to catch those often afterglows, as we call them, that don't have a gamma ray counterpart. Then you will be able to detect those things quite far off axis, and you don't necessarily need gravitational waves for that. But either way, this type of explanation holds just as well for long GRBs. The difference is that maybe the expected slopes of the energy and Lorentz factor profile are different in those jets, and the external medium, instead of being constant, it's maybe more likely to be a wind-like medium. But actually, all of the calculations that we did in this paper, we generalized them to a general external medium profile. So it's just a matter of plugging in the numbers of what do you want for this profile, and it's all there.
Okay, so I see. So you're saying the reason you need gravitational wave is that you know there is an event at that direction, and maybe it's faint, but you know it's there, so you can probably try to target.
Yeah, and for the afterglow, it's important to keep in mind that it took 10 days before the afterglow was detected for 17817. So people started observing about 8 hours after with X-ray, and I think X-ray was the first. And at first there was only upper limits. So if we go back, actually, I can show you the some of this data. Yeah, you can see here, all these arrows in the beginning, these are all upper limits. And so that was the case early on. There are even some earlier times here. Some of them are kind of cut off by the axis, some of these upper limits. But only at about 8 or something like that days after the event, there was the first detection. And you can see from the model why this is reasonable, because it's just so faint early on, right? So mm-hmm. We expect this to take a while before it's detectable.
Okay, cool. Okay, any additional question for Paz? All right, if not, let's thank Paz again for this very interesting talk.